Today, I'm with Ashley Berner, who is the Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy and also Assistant Professor of Education. She's the author of Pluralism and American Public Education, No One Way to School. She's published articles and book chapters on the relationship between educational structure and state funding in democratic nations, religious education and citizenship formation, and teacher preparation in different national contexts. Thanks for joining me today, Ashley.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So after reading your book and after reading the Education Next article that you wrote as a follow-up or as part of that book, you argue for a pluralistic vision of public education that is a little bit more similar to some of the Canadian provinces, to some of the European countries. And in the book, you say, or in the Education Next article, you say, from the early republic until the present day, Americans have never decided that education is merely a private good. In that same article, you link to a number of studies that affirm the contribution of private schools. However, it seems as if fears over privatization in the education market or the religious nature of many private schools inhibit inclusion in the greater education policy conversation. So how are you seeing, as you've written this book and as you've gotten feedback on the book, how are you seeing your arguments being accepted and then being received in this wider policy conversation? And then what challenges lie ahead for, you know, consideration of greater educational pluralism?
Those are very good questions, and I'll feel free to interrupt me or steer me in a different direction, but I'll take those separate questions in turn. First of all, what's been the reason I wrote the book is because my sense was we needed a new conversation in this country. There's because we have for 100 years interpreted public education to be one thing, which is government delivery of education. We don't realize as Americans that most democracies fund a variety of schools. In the Netherlands, they fund 36 different kinds of schools. Now they regulate them a bit more than we're probably accustomed to. But the point is that most democratic school systems are designed and constructed around diverse beliefs, commitments, and norms, and enabling access to those different kinds of schools. So I wanted to change the conversation and say, look, education doesn't have to be one thing. Most democracies don't make it one thing. And that gives us the space to redefine public education. So part of what you're seeing and the point you raised about concerns about privatization is simply because we're arguing against our cultural norm of one school. One type of school is public education. But public education can include, it can be much more capacious if we follow the lessons of other countries. As for how the book has been received, there has been, so I'm never going to please all comers in this argument. As the last chapter of my book says, pluralism is a middle path between education as an individual good and education as the prerogative of the state. So people who believe that only the government can deliver education will not like what I wrote, and in fact, they don't. Folks who believe that the government should fund schools but have their hands off in terms of quality will not like my argument, because I do assert that public funding needs to be accompanied by an assurance of quality, like most countries do. And we can follow up on that thread a little bit. But having said that, I've been gratified by the number of commissioners of education, national membership organizations, and national advocacy organizations have adapted this language of pluralism and indeed see it as a potential way through those two opposite poles.
So when you talk about, you know, accountability or even some of the measures to ensure quality, like how do you, in a pluralistic system, how do you do that without oftentimes the fear on the private school side is entanglement. Mm-hmm. You know, and so how do you do that without the entanglement? But then, you know, on the public school side of things, it's you know, a fairness and equitable sort of accountability. So how do you create accountability measures, or how have you seen that? And in the book, like, what arguments do you make to suggest that this would be a better way or a middle path that allows for the freedom to be, to allow schools to be distinct, to meet their missions, to meet the needs of their community, but then also to ensure quality?
Mm-hmm. That's the toughest question. And no country really has this right. How do you affirm individual differences in beliefs, even pedagogical differences? So Montessori is a very different pedagogical approach than a classical school, for example. And yet, so how do you affirm those differences while not funding something that actually doesn't serve kids? So I'll tell you the way that other countries do this well. They allow and fund diverse schools. In fact, in Alberta, the province even funds homeschoolers, Inuit schools, Catholic schools, Jewish schools, but they require that all of them use the same state curricular frameworks. So those frameworks are not specifying the way that content is delivered or even the messages that frame that content. But they ensure that every student who graduates from high school has passed or has taken an exit exam on all of these subjects. So for example, citizenship. I've looked at the Alberta, Canada citizenship curricular frameworks, and it's, you know, the history of Canada, the issues that have arisen, how democracy works, and so on. The curriculum documents look very different in Catholic schools than they do in state-delivered non-sectarian schools because the resources that the Catholic school community uses are very different. The same is true in a Montessori school and so forth. So that's one way that these democracies help drive social cohesion, is through access. And I think our founders supported this. When you look back at what Jefferson, Washington, Benjamin Rush, all of these folks felt that the way to prepare students for democracy included access to a robust and rigorous curriculum. So these other countries also do school inspections. The Netherlands and the UK, they don't compare across sectors. So they don't say, oh, well, state schools are better than Catholic schools. No, they don't compare across sectors, but every school is treated individually. They have independent parties that look at the classroom observations, do teacher and parent surveys. It's 27 measures in the UK and create a kind of multidimensional look at what's going on in a school and where that school has been. So they take historical and demographic data into consideration and have a dialogue with the school. And eventually in those two countries, although not in the other OECD countries, there are sanctions for schools that are not delivering a good education. So has it ever trespassed on a school's culture? I can think of one example of a state oversight of curriculum intruding on a school culture. And that happened in Quebec. The Ministry of Education in Quebec required all of its students, even those students who were not in publicly funded schools, to take the same curriculum. They'd always historically allowed that to be delivered in diverse ways. They changed their policy and required a very secular version of ethics and morality course. And this was very much contended. It went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the schools. So I don't really know of any other example, although I'm sure there are. But in general, pluralism tries to both support individual distinctive school cultures, because that works for students, and assure quality.
And it seems like in the United States, we've and it's different history and different path, we've done that more so in higher education. Mm-hmm. You know, why has it been so difficult over the last, let's say, just even 20, 30 years of even, you know, broadening a pluralistic understanding of policy for, you know, schools. Why has that been so difficult when it comes to, you know, the elementary and secondary education world?
Well, first of all, I really wish there were more accountability for higher education, because some of our community colleges and even four-year colleges are not graduating a very high percentage of students, particularly first generation and low income students. Unfortunately, a huge bit of the burden of that falls on the shoulders of the K through 12 system, which has not effectively prepared those students. But you ask why it's so difficult. I think it's difficult because we've had for a long bit of time a view of education, K through 12 education, that the classroom teacher is in charge of the classroom and that designs his or her own curriculum. We haven't had the supports for teachers in their pre-service programs or indeed in their in-service professional development that will support high quality instructions, high quality curricular materials. We just haven't had that. And so our teachers have suffered, our students have suffered, and we've ended up with this external accountability measure like teacher evaluations, which were a big part of Race to the Top. Those have not been well received. In fact, most states are backing away from them. There's a kind of punitive edge to the accountability that comes from it's a proxy for some of the failures of our system earlier on in teachers' careers. But I think there are lots of factors that make change difficult. That's only one of them.
Yeah, and you kind of mentioned, you know, a couple things. We go from, even in my career, which really started around the transition for NCLB, mm-hmm. then, you know, the addition of kind of Race to the Top, and then now the shift to the Every Student Succeeds Act, mm-hmm. ESSA. So it seems like one of the things that I've learned in my career is that there's not a level of consistency that allows us to gain even traction in what we do from a policy aspect, so that myself as a practitioner, that the inconsistencies then in my practice become, you know, maybe probably I get about 5 years and then there's change.
Yes.
5 years.
Yes. And I think this is where other countries probably have us, at least some other countries really have it right, that two things really matter, just in terms of student outcomes: robust and rigorous and academic curriculum. I mean, this is the OECD, this is James Coleman's work in Catholic schools and so forth, Tony Bright's work, high quality, rigorous curriculum narrows the achievement gap, and strong school cultures and really equipping teachers for those two things. When states do that, when they pay attention to those few policy levers, things get better. So Massachusetts, in its Education Reform Act in the 1990s, changed its assessments, changed its curriculum, required all the state actually spent a lot of time back mapping. What does a student need to know when she enters freshman year of college, and back mapped from the content all the way back to kindergarten? And train the teachers. All of the professional development was geared for curriculum and so forth. The teacher certification process changed to emphasize teacher content. Massachusetts became the highest performing state in the country, and actually is one of the highest performing systems in the world. Louisiana is going through some remarkable instructional shifts right now. And I will commend the Commissioner of Education there, John White, and his Chief Academic Officer, Rebecca Kochler, because they've brought teachers along in saying, we must have high-quality instructions and high-quality instructional materials. They have adjusted the procurement strategies so that at this point, 80% of the teachers in Louisiana are teaching from Eureka Math, which is one of the highest quality, highest caliber math curricula out there. And to their credit, they also work with charter schools and private schools. They give professional development not only to district schools, but to any teacher in the system in Louisiana who who's interested and available. So this is, they're changing not only the tone about what kind of schools matter, they're saying all the schools matter, and they're actually providing the resources. And I predict that Louisiana, well, first of all, its NAEP scores are rising, and I predict that will continue.
And so using that example of Louisiana, and I think I just read it, whether it was in your article, but something around 96% of students in New Orleans go to charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of, you know, there's, and charter schools have grown in the last decade to be about 6% of the, you know, the population of students go to charter schools. Like, so how do charter schools fit into this pluralistic system? And then how have you seen just the growth of this and the support of states as an opportunity for more parents and more students to have choices and options that fit their interests and their needs?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So first of all, charters very much fit into the pluralistic model because charters, although they can't legally be religious charters, they can create distinctive school cultures and hire faculty around that and invite parents into an organic community that supports certain things and not others. So a great example of this is Scott Sider's book, Character Compass, where he looks at three different charter schools in Boston that are all high performing and all have very different moral frameworks. And it works really, really well. Charters, of course, when you look at performance, are very uneven. In some markets, the charter schools perform, if you look at test scores, below the district schools. In others, like Boston and Newark, the charter schools virtually erase the achievement gaps between wealthy and poor students. And so I see charters as a very healthy thing. I think what I'd love to see is the expansion of a generosity between charters and private schools. There's sometimes some real competition between charters and private schools. And providing more funding for private schools would certainly make that a little easier, I think.
And so, like, one of the, I think, arguments for, you know, the pluralistic approach is that you make is that it allows schools to be more distinct as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, a little bit of the research that I've seen, but the bigger questions is that when schools are allowed to be more distinct, then, you know, some of those measures on accountability measures, state measures or tests, that they perform better. And we see that where charter schools are, that oftentimes the main, you know, comprehensive public school actually improves and does better on its own. How does a system like this not become a competitive system, but is a system that supports the many different types and the many different opportunities to, I think, you know, to create what you use is a little bit of that old term of the common good. You know, how is this about the larger common good? How is it about not us competing against them, but us doing this together in somewhat different fashions and ways?
Mm-hmm. So it's a good question. A lot of different good questions all tied up into one, and I'll try to respond to each of them, but please bring me back if I forget one. The common good is the just first and foremost justification for funding schools in the first place. When you look back at the speeches that were made at our founding, And England, for example, in 1833, when they passed the first bill to fund education, which had been delivered by private individuals and church communities and temples and so on, it was about creating citizens and helping them participate in the common good. Now, democracy can't for a moment assume that we all agree about what the ultimate common good is. We don't. We can't. I mean, part of the point of democracy is we have profound disagreements about the good, the true, and the beautiful, as James Davison Hunter would say. But if we don't have a common conversation, we can't even have a commonwealth, as it were. That's one of the justifications for a common curriculum, is having access to the same ideas and being able to have robust public square conversations. Now, the common good has another aspect that comes up when we talk about school outcomes, and that is civic outcomes. So we're looking for, we have always looked for public education, not just to give people skills that they can use in the workforce, although it's about that, but we're also looking for measures of democratic participation and social cohesion. And political scientists look at this from many different measures, but there are four key measures. One is voluntary activity. The other is tolerance for those with whom we profoundly disagree. The third is having the civic skills of engagement. Do you know how to write a letter to your congressman? Do you know how to interpret a law? And then the fourth is the civic knowledge, just knowing how democratic institutions work. And one of the reasons we have a uniform school system is because many Protestants did not believe that Catholics would ever be able to do that. They wouldn't be able to engage and participate in democracy. This is a 19th century bigotry that looked down on the hierarchical nature of Catholic beliefs and practices. And so the publicly funded education became Protestantized, and it was Protestantized until the 1960s. The interesting thing is that on every one of those measures of civic engagement, Catholic high schools in particular have got everybody else beat. Catholic high schools and to some extent independent non-religious schools have an outsized independent effect on all four of those measures, not just when students are in college, but throughout their lives. So if we're looking to advance the common good, there's a very good bet that having communities that are distinctive and giving them access to high quality materials and education, those will create more civic behavior. That's my bet. I'm guessing the Islamic schools and many of the Jewish day schools. Now there's a lot of variety in the quality of all of these schools, but Catholic high schools, Islamic high schools are looking pretty good. Classical high schools as well.
And so, you know, as we look, you know, look backwards at some of those lessons, and as you put this in the book, 2017 has been an interesting year for mm-hmm. many reasons. But even from an education policy aspect, you know, from the different states and some of the decisions that have been made there, like, what are you seeing when you look back even at this year when it comes to some of the changes in states like Illinois or mm-hmm. even, you know, so Arizona, I think, is another, mm-hmm. and then other states. And then what's your analysis of this tax bill and how it might impact this idea of greater opportunity in educational pluralism?
Mm-hmm. So I'm not a tax expert. I'll just address that first. I know that I and many religious leaders are quite concerned about the current bill, in that what was it renders scholarships taxable income. So if you're a Catholic school, and most Catholic schools have enormous scholarships, most religious schools have scholarships, so those who don't have enough money can attend. Even those scholarships will count as taxable income for the families. That's a huge problem for low-income families, and I'm quite worried about that. Of course, the same thing applies in higher education. If you're a first-generation student and you're in an Ivy League college on full scholarships, all of that money is taxable income for you. It may make it impossible for first-generation students to have equal access at K through 12 or higher ed. So that's a flag that I know a lot of us are worried about, hoping that they can remediate that. As far as the last year, I have seen significant interest in the states in crafting school choice policies that are also accountable to the public. Our institute is about to release a policy brief that provides guidance to chiefs, commissioners of education and non-public school leaders as they think about the policy environment around pluralism. So I will send you a copy of that and love for you to take a look and comment. Some of the bills in particular, some of the laws have been interesting. One of my favorites is Illinois. Illinois has managed to create what we could call a grand bargain. It's not a zero-sum game. So at the same time, the legislature authorized a $74 million tax credit bill. Those students who are on scholarship will take the state exam. There's enough funding for that. And at the same time, they redesigned the funding formula for the whole state and gave a lot of money, additional money, to Chicago Public Schools, which is this is struggling. So nobody was completely happy with the deal. You read the press afterwards and people said, look, this was a compromise. That's what a compromise is. It's not winner takes all. And when I look back at educational history, there are other examples of grand bargains of a sort. So when Alberta, Canada redid its public education system in the 90s, it too redesigned the funding mechanism so that education wasn't contingent on property values, and expanded school choice options, and implemented a high quality curriculum for the first time in decades. That's interesting and encouraging.
So let me ask maybe one last question, because this is all, I love this, and I want to point people back to the articles and the book and, you know, other areas to get more information. But one of the last things from a policy aspect that I've been wondering about is the influx of maybe over the last 10 years, but it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but an influx of private money from wealthy foundations, wealthy donors, into the education system to try to transform, change. How is that created? It seems to me, and maybe this is an overstatement, it's created a little bit of a dissonance in the system for policymakers. And how do we navigate, you know, an influx of the changes in policy, the changes in government structures or funding mechanisms, but then also, How do we understand the influx of private money into what has traditionally been a very public system?
Mm-hmm. So, good questions. The money is significant. The fact is that public education has always been funded by private foundations. So the Ford Foundation, for example, has put a lot of money into urban systems for decades and decades and decades, Annenberg, so forth. There are lots of investment in public education because we know how important it is. Several things have changed, and that is that some of this private money or foundation money, which is technically non-for-profit, is going for reforming the system. So you have had the Gates Foundation and other major players trying to create small high schools in New York, or funding data-driven systems, or redoing teacher evals, and so on. So that's pushed the system, and there has been pushback. Let's not pretend that there's not a huge amount of money on the side of maintaining district structures. So the teacher unions have historically fought, as they should, because it's their job, fought for the maintenance of the district school system as it exists. And there's a lot of money that goes into political campaigns around that too. It would be nice It will be nice if we get to a point in which education is nonpartisan and non-political. It will never be completely non-political, but we should pull it away as far as possible from the political battles, that because only children get hurt with that. The issue with private funding for charter schools is it has been substantial and in many cases very, very helpful for students, because charter schools in most states don't receive full facilities funding and have to have startup funds and buildings and so forth to operate. It probably couldn't have happened to this degree without investment from philanthropy. Money is ambivalent. There's a great book by Sarah Reckow called Follow the Money that looks at what's happened in some big urban districts like Los Angeles and New York, and shows the ambivalence of it. It's an understandable ambivalence, but I don't think we should be under any illusion that the only people spending money are philanthropists that want the system to be more reformed.
Okay. So are you up for any predictions for 2018 as we're coming to the end of the year in this
round? Oh, I'm going to be an optimist, and I'm going to say, I don't know if it's a prediction, but it's a hope. It's a hope that the tone around public education can become more collaborative and less competitive, that we will get to a space in some cities And I think city leaders play a big role, probably city leaders and state superintendents and legislatures more than district leaders because of where they sit, where there's a tone of all schools matter, all of our students matter. We're going to solve common problems like transportation. It's a huge problem. Mm-hmm. Denver's solving it, you know, working with charters and districts. Bring private schools into that. These are all our students. They all matter. That's my hope.
Ashley, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time, your expertise, and look forward to future conversations.
Thank you so much, Eric. It's been a pleasure.